Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. Last week we touched briefly on the topic of de-extinction. This was with Michigan historical writer Bill Loomis, who joined us for a great segment about the history of the passenger pigeon in our state. There has been an effort underway right out of the pages of Jurassic Park to bring back the passenger pigeon using the DNA of birds that have been in science labs and natural history museums for 100 years or more. It's a fascinating subject. I just wanted to say that if you would like to learn more, we're recommending an article that we read here for the Bill Loomis segment. It's from the New York Times from Thursday, February 27th. Google it and check it out. It was a real eye-opener. It's called The Mammoth Cometh by Nathaniel Rich in the New York Times, Thursday, February 27th. Just Google New York Times Mammoth. It'll pop up about fourth down the list. It is intriguing reading, to say the least. Later this hour, some Michigan communities might be impacted by climate change. We'll talk with a Michigan State University scholar who is studying that. We'll talking about Michigan's reinvestment in higher education as well with Doug Rothwell, who is the CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, all coming up on Current State. At the top of our program, a deal to renew federal benefits for the country's long-term unemployed continues to elude the U.S. Congress, but supporters of the effort, which include Democrats and a growing number of Republicans, are hopeful of a breakthrough in the Senate as early as this week. There, senators are looking at two proposals, one from each party. Since the benefits expired back in December, several Senate votes have failed to generate enough support among Republicans to pass. Disagreements have centered on the length of an extension and how to pay for it. Long-term jobless benefits apply to persons who have been out of work 27 weeks or more. Federal data released last Friday show that while the ranks of Americans out of work for less than 5 weeks has actually fallen, the number of long-term jobless increased by about 200,000 just last month. For his take on the debate over extending unemployment insurance, we welcome back from the U.S. House Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint Township. Hi, Dan. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's good to be on.
Before we explore what's going on in the Senate, which is very interesting, clarify for us where a long-term unemployment extension stands in your chamber in the House.
Well, we have, you know, strong support among the Democrats, and I think increasing support among, I guess, what you'd call rank-and-file Republicans, not the House leadership, but those that, you know, that are just thinking about their home district and what they're dealing with. The difficulty here in the House is that it seems as though Speaker Boehner is unwilling to act until the Senate takes a position, and then that will trigger House action, which honestly is very frustrating because that's never been the history of the Congress, that the House sits around waiting for the Senate to act. The norm actually has been the other way around, but in the case of Speaker Boehner, he prefers to wait for the Senate to act. And, of course, that's something that we're all keeping a close eye on.
Well, I want to pursue that just for a second because the mood of the House appears to have changed significantly in recent months, mainly after the Ryan Murray budget compromise last December and after Speaker Boehner's repudiation of the Tea Party. Did the mood in the room change as significantly as we've been led to believe, and is that mood still in the room 3 months or so later?
Well, unfortunately, I think it depends on the issue. When it came to the debt ceiling increase, for example, clearly the Speaker was willing to say to the Tea Party, step aside, we're going to move on this. Of course, he was only able to deliver 28 votes even for the debt ceiling increase. The Democrats carried that vote, all but two of our members and only 28 of his. So the mood, unfortunately, is still one that's quite partisan. The difficulty is that with the Ryan Murray budget agreement, which I voted for, we hoped and many of us pushed to put the unemployment extension into that package. because they were unwilling to do that, there was a commitment to take unemployment up in January. Well, January's passed, February's passed, and here we are almost halfway through March. And I think for some who ideologically oppose this, I think they're just trying to run out the clock. And, you know, to me, the problem with that is this is not like some abstract concept. There are 2 million Americans who have lost their benefits, that can't pay their car bill, that can't pay their rent or their mortgage, that are struggling to keep the heat on and put groceries on the table. That's the human cost for the inaction of Congress. So this is not some abstraction.
How are the long-term unemployed faring in your district?
Well, it's tough. I mean, we've had our district in particular, you know, this focus on long-term unemployment is even greater. Older communities that are having a more difficult time making the transition out of manufacturing into some, you know, the next economy, particularly have long-term unemployment. And that's what we're seeing. As you said, short-term unemployment may be going down, but the long-term problem, that's where the real difficulty is, and that's what these benefits are intended to get at.
We're talking with Congressman Dan Kildee about efforts in the U.S. Congress to extend unemployment insurance. Let's look at the two measures that the Senate is looking at. Your Democratic colleagues are proposing a six-month extension, retroactive to December 28th, a $6 billion price tag. Where would the money come from to pay for that?
Well, we've offered, and you know, it's a moving target in the Senate right now. So we've offered a number of potential sources for the so-called pay for. That's the term that folks use around here. My preference is that we just saved $11 billion by passing a bipartisan farm bill. It was a bipartisan decision. We ought to assign those savings, which are not anticipated in the Ryan Murray budget, so it's available for us to redesignate. We ought to assign those savings for this short-term unemployment extension. But there have been other methods. There's something called pension smoothing that allows private employers to use a different calculation for the way they contribute to pensions, and that would put more money into their profits, which increases revenues because it becomes subject to taxation. But here's the problem with the so-called pay-fors. Every time we come up with a way to pay for it, it's not good enough for those who oppose this. So it's a bit disingenuous for members in the Senate and in the House to continue to obsess on how we're going to pay for it, because every time we come up with a way to pay for it, it's not good enough. And under President George W. Bush, who was the last president to sign emergency unemployment extension, there was no pay for, because it's understood that this is sort of the equivalent of a storm, of a natural disaster. 2 million people have temporarily lost their income. We don't sit around and try to figure out whether or not we're going to act when things like this happen, when an emergency occurs. We act and we figure it out within the context of our long-term budget discussions. And that's what I think we really ought to be doing.
Are you hearing Republicans say that money saved in the farm bill should stay out of the budget, or are they receptive to that idea?
Well, some. I mean, I think what we're seeing is among many of the Republicans, though, that I would sort of put in the category of the old school Republicans, the fiscal conservatives but not ideological types, they're willing to compromise on that subject. But there are some, and this has been the frustration for me, that every time we make a deal, like we just did the Ryan budget deal, or not the Ryan budget deal, but the bipartisan budget deal.
Ryan Murray.
Yeah. Ryan Murray deal. So now that becomes the starting point for further cuts for many within the Republican conference. Not all, but many. And so the frustration, of course, for me is, when is a deal a deal? That Ryan Murray budget was a significant compromise. It significantly reduced over what had been previous levels, our discretionary spending levels. But it can't be that every time we compromise, the next deal or the next set of actions has to be further reductions from that compromise. We ought to have a fair argument about how we spend the money that we've agreed to spend, that's for sure. But not every time that we make a deal do we have to come back with every decision that we make and use that as leverage to get further reductions in really essential programs.
Let's talk a bit about the Republican measure here. Republicans are proposing a $5 billion measure, again, retroactive to December 28th, which, as you pointed out, would use what's called pension smoothing to pay for it. But I also noticed that part of the package would also make reforms to the unemployment system, including requiring applicants to show how they plan to return to the workforce. What do you make of those provisions?
Well, I think based on my experience, that's an unnecessary and political poison pill. The people that I know, and this is the thing, I think it's insulting and somewhat condescending for people here in Washington, most of whom in the Senate are millionaires, imposing what they think is in the minds of unemployed this notion that they don't want to work. Everybody I know, and I mean this without exception, everybody I know receiving unemployment compensation would today give up unemployment in order to have a job where they go to work every day, they feel good about the contributions they make to their community, they support their family. There's this bizarre ideology that people who are unemployed, or for that matter, people who are poor, want to be in that position. And to me, it's kind of a condescending and, as I said, insulting position for millionaire senators in Washington to take about people that they obviously don't understand.
I know veterans are a particular concern for you. It appears they are being hit particularly hard here.
Right. Of the 2 million people who have lost their unemployment extension, 200,000 of them are veterans. So they're disproportionately paying the price for this weak economy. And the reason that that's important, and the reason I have raised that, is that there are many here in Washington who pat themselves on the back or beat their chest and give great speeches about how they will do anything within their power to support our returning veterans, except in this case they won't, or in that case they won't. To me, we owe our veterans more than a good speech. We've got to take this to the floor, and those veterans who are looking for work, they ought to be receiving some kind of support, and that's true for all. But to me, it's particularly ironic and I think somewhat hypocritical for so many around the Capitol to talk good game when it comes to veterans, but when it comes time to actually showing up for the vote, they're nowhere to be found.
Some Republicans do have repeatedly accused Majority Leader Reid of being more interested in blaming them for being obstructionist than in actually passing a measure. What do you make of that criticism?
Well, all it would have taken is one more Republican to vote in favor of unemployment extension, and we would have been there. So it's pretty disingenuous to blame the person who is for something for the fact that it hasn't happened yet, when it's fully within the hands of Republicans. And, you know, I see that in the House, too, that people accuse us of all just trying to make political hay. We're willing to give the Republicans credit for bringing it up. We have a discharge petition in the House, which would only take a handful of Republicans. All they have to do is sign their name on the bottom line of a petition to the Speaker, which would force a vote. So we're using every tool we have, not just the politics of this, but every tool we have legislatively to move this forward. But, you know, those who oppose this for a variety of reasons prefer to cast it in political terms, and that's been the thing that's bothering me so much. This is not a political question for the people back home who are losing their house, who are losing their car, who can't find enough food to put on the table, who can't keep the house warm.
What are you hearing with regard to the chances of an actual vote in the Senate on one of these measures this week?
Well, we hope that it'll come this week, but the Senate has its own arcane rules, and again, it's very difficult to predict what they'll do. It will take a couple of Republicans, or at least one, changing their mind on this subject. And so it's hard to predict what will happen. All I can say is this, that each week that passes, the pressure on Congress will become greater. There are 2 million people who have lost their benefits, but each week that passes, there are another 70,000 Americans that lose emergency unemployment benefits. Those voices are going to get louder and louder. And my view on this is that Congress should act now before this gets to even greater crisis levels.
And Congressman, just to close, if some kind of measure were to pass the Senate, how much are you inclined to think majority Republicans in the House would want to change that?
Would change what came out of the Senate?
Yes.
Well, that would be the difficulty, and it would seem to me that the best solution would be an up or down vote on what the Senate brings up. And if that means that it's passed with almost all the Democrats and a less than a majority of the Republicans, I think that's a better outcome. If we start getting into a ping-pong match back and forth with the Senate over specific provisions, you know, this thing could go on for months and months, and I'd hate to see that happen.
We've been talking with Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee, the Democrat from Flint Township. Dan, good talking to you. Good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Trying to determine the impacts of climate change is a difficult task. There are hundreds of different factors which could determine how communities are influenced. To more effectively understand the challenges associated with climate change, scientists are using a system of system dynamics models. Laura Schmidt Olabisi is an ecologist and modeler here at Michigan State University. She spoke with Current State's Emmanuel Berry about her latest project, which explores how higher temperatures could impact Detroit. Olabisi says there are three major hurdles in determining the effects of climate change.
I would say that there are three major challenges with this. One is the high level of uncertainty associated with how climate change is going to impact communities. And that's not only the uncertainty of how the climate will change, but also uncertainty about how people are going to react to it, the decisions people are going to make in the future. People are highly unpredictable. Another aspect is that makes it difficult is the fact that the effects of climate change and the decisions that people make around it are often removed in time and space from where the impacts of those decisions occur. So you might decide to do something now that will have consequences decades into the future or hundreds of miles downstream. And so we need ways of thinking about that in the whole context. And then the third thing is that there are so many different interests and perspectives involved in a lot of these decisions that we make in terms of adapting to climate change. So people have different perspectives, and those perspectives need to be considered.
So to try and make sense, essentially, of all of these different facets, you work with what's called system dynamics models, or system dynamic modeling. Mm-hmm. Explain exactly what that is. Give us the broken down version.
Sure. So system dynamics modeling is a technique that's been around for several decades now. It began around the 1960s, a gentleman named Jay Forrester working at MIT. And it's been applied in environmental fields more recently. And applied to participatory modeling, which is what I do in terms of building models with people who are not modelers or often not even scientists. And it's a type of modeling you can do on the computer, and it has a kind of symbolic language, so people are able to see how the model is constructed and how the different pieces relate to one another. And it helps you to see how a system behaves over time. in response to different decisions that you might make or different things that might happen. So you can see those dynamics, hence the name, play mm-hmm. out over time.
So you created a model to address the impact of a heat wave in the city of Detroit or increased heat. So what went into building this model and running these simulations? As you said, it's a participatory model, so you're asking people who aren't scientists to kind of contribute. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, we first thought of the idea for this in collaboration with the Michigan Department of Community Health. They are very concerned about the issue of extreme heat in Michigan because it does affect a lot of people's health. And in the United States overall, extreme heat kills more people per year than, I think it's earthquakes, floods, and tornadoes combined. So it's a pretty extreme problem.
Any natural disaster.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and you don't hear a lot about it because often the people who are affected are elderly and poor, and many live in the urban areas. So we decided to interview some people who had knowledge of this, the effects of extreme heat in Michigan. So we interviewed county health officials, we interviewed some emergency management people, planners, I think one medical examiner, and we had them just talk about how extreme heat plays out and how it affects people's health. And we used those conversations and the things that they mentioned to actually build the model. So it's taking their knowledge and putting it into this framework in order to bring it back then to a larger group of people to help look at different decisions they might make to reduce deaths and hospitalizations during an extreme heat event.
So when you interviewed these various community stakeholders, I guess what were some of their thoughts or concerns that they presented?
Well, they had a lot of different perspectives and ideas around, for example, the best way to prevent people's health from being impacted. So we talked a lot about cooling centers. One thing that several people had observed is that you can open a cooling center, which is a place with air conditioning mm-hmm. that people can go to during an extreme event if they don't have air conditioning. But oftentimes people don't actually go, and there was some confusion about why that is. So one of the things this revealed to us is how important people's behavior is during heat events, and that's something that hasn't been looked at a lot yet, because what people choose to do in terms of their behavior can drastically affect their health outcomes. So do they know or are they able to turn on the air conditioner or go to a cooling center? So these are some of the things we explored in the model.
So people are just sort of, they're unaware of the fact that they're even being impacted in a way?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they're not aware that they're in a vulnerable category, even if they are. They may not be aware of the effects that certain medications may have on increasing their risk in terms of exposure to heat, for example. But also they may not choose to go to a cooling center for other reasons, because they can't get there, or they don't think that it's something that they want to do in terms of leaving their house and going to a new place. So we explored all of those dynamics in the model and looked at, you know, what might be the most significant things that affect people's health outcomes during a heat event.
Well, what were some other significant findings after running this model?
Well, we did actually zero in on the fact that people's behavior is extremely important and really needs to be looked into more. And so one of the outcomes was the realization that putting in more cooling centers on its own is not going to help during an extreme heat event unless people know that they should go to them and feel comfortable going to them. So that was one kind of outcome. We also looked at the potential impact of a brownout during a heat event and found that that was pretty significant, because obviously that shuts off people's air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And that's challenging because when temperatures are very hot, people use electricity more to run their air conditioners, for example, and that can increase the potential of a brownout. So this is kind of an example of what we call feedback loop in systems, that one thing leads to another, which then leads back to impact the first thing.
So you mentioned there that you tested a brownout. So there's different scenarios, essentially, that you can test within this same model then.
Yeah, and it was actually kind of fun. So during the workshop that we held in Detroit, this is May of 2012 now, we had different small groups at each table that had a copy of the model and a modeler helping to explain things to them, and they could choose scenarios to run in the model and choose to kind of play with it, almost like a video game. And so I think they actually enjoyed it and had a lot of fun with that.
How will these findings be considered or possibly look to when people are implementing community plans?
Well, we're still working with the Department of Community Health on that. This is something that they want to follow up on and continue to explore across the state. And we're actually applying for more funding to expand the model beyond just Detroit and hopefully to other cities in Michigan and in the Midwest.
As you said, there's a lot of different stakeholders when it comes to addressing even just the simple problem of dealing with increased heat. And then you take that even further, and there's a bunch of different stakeholders and opinions when addressing climate change in general. How do you think that models help kind of generate a dialogue between all these different groups with all these different thoughts?
I think that one of the main ways they do that is that a model forces you to put all of your assumptions about the way a system works out there very explicitly, and even to test them. So it helps, because sometimes when people are fighting about an issue or have different perspectives on an issue, they're actually operating from different assumptions. Mm-hmm. And if you get back to those root assumptions, you can really tackle, you know, the root cause of a disagreement or find common ground, actually. And so that's one thing that I think models are very helpful for. Another thing is that sometimes, and this happens for all of us, sometimes our perceptions about the way a system works are wrong. And sometimes we need to test that by looking at how different things play out over time using a model. And sometimes we can find out that maybe our hoped for outcome is never going to happen because it's physically impossible, for example. So I've used models in that way as well.
So if people wanted to find out more about this information, where can they go?
Well, this work was funded through the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment Center, or GLESA, which is jointly operated between the University of Michigan and Michigan State. And there's a report online about this work that's available through the GLESA website, glesa.org.
Laura Schmidt-Obisi is a Michigan State University systems ecologist and system dynamics modeler. Laura, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel.
Music from the band Tenarawan, which is a band of Tuareg musicians from northern Mali. And if you would like to ever learn more about any of the music that you hear on Current State in between the segments and thereabouts, we tweet it every day at KAR Current State. Tenarawan is the name of the band from Mali. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, trying to deter, after years of controversial cuts to higher education, Michigan has begun reinvesting in its colleges and universities. Last month, Governor Rick Snyder proposed a 6.1% spending hike for Michigan's state-funded four-year institutions. Higher education officials applauded the move, which would be contingent on universities limiting tuition increases. On a more sobering note, Michigan got a reminder last week of how much farther it needs to go to catch up with other states in terms of state per pupil spending. A nationwide report from the Chronicle of Higher Education shows Michigan in 40th place in that category. Now, our next guest, while not from academia, supports the increased reinvestment of state spending in higher education. Doug Rothwell, CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, a nonprofit group comprised of the top executives of dozens of the state's top job providers, GM, Meyer, Two Men in a Truck, and on, along with university presidents from around the state. Doug Rothwell, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
Talk to us in general, Doug, about the return on investment for higher education. And I'd be especially interested if your members noticed a declining return on investment since education cutting began a dozen or so years ago.
Well, the main problem that we face right now is that we're making it more difficult for kids to get an education at the very time that there's more demand than ever before. If you look at the jobs that are being created today, and this is even more so in the years ahead, more of them are going to require an education beyond high school. We also know even those graduates that came out of college during the recent recession earn far more than those that didn't get a college degree, and also have much lower unemployment rates, and of course then they're going to require less government services because they're not going to be needing different forms of assistance as they grow older. And so what all of this says is that we need college education more than ever before, but it needs to be affordable. It needs to be affordable for kids to be able to get it. And over the last decade, we went from being a top 10 state in affordability to bottom 10. We kind of corrected that a little bit the last few years when we stopped the cutting and started reinvesting. But this year is a real opportunity to make a really big gain in this effort.
That's quite a steep climb, though, to go from the bottom 10 to the top 10.
Well, it is. And, you know, all states really experienced problems during the recession maintaining the level of support that they did provide to higher education. But no state really suffered it more than Michigan did because, of course, our economy took a bigger hit than just about any place else in the country. But the point is, now that revenues are coming back, it's a real opportunity for us to turn that around. And that's why the governor's budget proposal this year is so important to get through the legislature. If we could get this 6% increase this year, that begins to put us back on a trajectory that we can see over the next 5 to 10 years getting back to that top 10 status, which we think is so important.
Generally, Doug, are you and your members confident that the Michigan economy can continue to grow to the point where these increased reinvestments in higher education are going to be realistically possible?
We really are. Not only are we optimistic that the Michigan economy is going to continue to grow, at least for the next few years, which is, you know, hard to see much further than that, but right now it looks very positive, but also the fact that the way you need to reinvest in higher education is far different than, say, road funding. You know, the need for us to fix our roads is in the billions of dollars that we're going to need to invest. And it's very hard to do that just by allocating incremental amounts of the existing budget to fix it. And that's why we and many other groups believe that some form of tax increase is going to be needed to fix that problem. Higher education doesn't have such a severe funding need. If we simply increased funding by about $100 million a year, over the next 5 to 10 years, we would get to be a top 10 state. And so this year, good example, the governor's proposing about an $80 million increase. If we keep doing that for a period of years, we will get to this goal. It's a much more achievable goal than having to go out and find, you know, $1 billion or $1.5 billion.
Does your organization espouse a particular tax approach here? You did allude to the desirability of a tax increase.
We've not taken a position on the way to do that to fix the roads. Again, we think with higher education, you know, what we're talking about here, we don't need a tax increase. We can do that through incremental revenue increases as the economy continues to improve. Roads are going to probably need a tax increase of some type. The governor's proposal, we think, is as good as any. I'm sure there are other ideas out there as well. I think our, you know, basic point would be, let's do something.
There is the interpretation out there that education reinvestment is to be expected in an election year budget. Is this an election year tactic, or do your members detect a sincere effort on the part of the administration to make a long-term reinvestment in education?
We think it's very sincere. I think that the fact that the governor even tried to increase funding over the last 2 years when the revenues weren't as robust shows that he was very committed to higher education. That first year when he had to make the cuts, you know, we were facing at that point over a $1 billion budget deficit. And, you know, unfortunately, higher education is probably more cuttable than other things in the budget. It's hard to cut Medicaid. It's hard to cut, you know, road funding, things like that when higher education can increase tuition. But the unfortunate part about that is we've been doing it now for a decade, and we've gotten ourselves in a pretty deep hole. We think the governor absolutely is committed to this, and I think, again, this year his budget shows very clearly that he sees this as a long-term priority for the state.
Doug, some people think that Michigan needs to take a hard look at how it funds education as well. Now, you just expressed confidence that the economy could grow in future years to really significantly reinvest in that. But should we be looking at different mechanisms as far as funding education?
Well, you know, it's always a controversial subject, and, you know, clearly you look at the work that we had to go through as a state to even get Proposal A passed for K-12 education back, you know, 20 years ago, and, you know, today we're still talking about whether there are ways to improve it or fix it in some way, shape, or form. You know, again, I think that with higher education, we have a need here that is much more achievable. The amount of dollars that are needed to get us to be where we need to be should be able to be found from the existing way the budget is structured, the way our existing revenues come into the state. And again, if we just achieve modest economic growth over the next 5 to 10 years, we should be able to achieve this goal. So, you know, again, unlike road funding, you know, we don't see that we need a fundamental change of tax policy here to get to where we want to be.
What about K-12 and early childhood, Doug? Does business leaders place relatively more emphasis on the importance of higher ed than, say, K-12 or early childhood? And if so, why?
No, we don't. I mean, we think it's extremely important that the entire education system be a priority for Michigan, and we've been a big supporter of the expansion of early childhood funding, which, of course, the governor and the legislature have already supported. For K-12, we think it's vitally important that it perform as well as it possibly can. We're very concerned that in Michigan, only 21% of our 11th graders are deemed to be college or career ready for when they graduate the following year. We think that's just you know, a very difficult situation. We have got to improve. But with K-12 education, you know, we're certainly not in favor of cutting, but we do believe that we should be getting probably more value for the money that we are spending. We are a state that is an above average investor in K-12 education, but our results have been below average now for some time. And so I know that there are a variety of different actions being taken to improve the K-12 system. For example, we've been big supporters of the implementation of the Common Core state standards. We believe that that ought to in turn be tied to some form of student assessment, which is under debate in the legislature right now. Those kinds of steps we think are very important. We don't necessarily think it's a funding issue. We think it's more how we're spending the money and how can we be more efficient at it.
I came across an interesting quote from Eileen Weiser, who's a member of the state school board. She told Bridge Magazine a year ago that, quote, "dumping more money in the system is not a solution. Michigan has in various times been in the top 10 in funding schools, but in the bottom half of student achievement." She says, if there were a relationship between money and competence, it would show up in the results. How do you answer contrarians who don't link investment with results?
Well, we think that we ought to be an above-average state investing in K-12 education, and we are. So, again, our position is that this should be a priority for the state, but we already think that it is. In fact, one of the things that we have to remember in Michigan is our demographics, our student enrollment has actually been declining for some time. So we actually have, if you think about it, more money per kid put into K-12 education than we maybe did a couple of years ago. But again, the point is that what are you getting for that? And I think that we have a system that, you know, needs to continue to change and evolve. And if we can do things like have better standards, the Common Core state standards, tie it to assessments that give our kids a better sense of where they stand, and that begins to then chip away at that performance issue, which, you know, Elaine and others have said, you know, could be improved. Again, our position is it should be a funding priority, but the point is, what are we getting for that funding?
Beyond the issue of funding, Doug, are Michigan universities graduating students with the degrees and the particular skills that your members need?
Yeah, and I mean, this is a good contrast to K-12, which we were just talking about. In higher education, we now have a performance-based funding system in place in Michigan that looks specifically at things like what are their college graduation rates, are they turning out graduates in critical skill areas, what is the administrative efficiency of these universities, what amount of research and development dollars are they attracting. So in other words, it's not a blank check that universities are getting in order to, you know, receive those state monies. With K-12 education, we don't have a system like that so much. It's really more based on how many kids or slots, if you will, we need to underwrite. And so with higher education, we think we've made a lot of progress to address the question that you addressed, which is, you know, we're providing more money, but we're providing it based on the universities doing a better job of performance.
And real briefly, Doug, thumbs up or thumbs down on the governor's call for more skilled immigrants for Detroit?
Well, thumbs up. I mean, we need more people in Michigan, and we should be welcoming immigrants, more out-of-state college students, et cetera. We need to grow our state.
Doug Rothwell is CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, the nonprofit group comprised of the top executives of dozens of the state's top job providers and universities. Doug, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. MSU Global is featuring the photography of Ana Luisa Cardona, a Michigan-based artist. Part of the exhibit features an exploration in visual communication between her and the late Bay Area artist and photographer Daniel Del Solar. Cardona is also a passionate advocate for arts education and serves as a consultant to the Michigan Arts Education Instruction and Assessment Program. She joins us in studio here to talk about her work and about arts education. Welcome.
Good morning.
When you say you look at images as language, what do you mean?
Well, they speak to us, and in combination, they can say a variety of things. For many years, I've been interested in how images speak to us as distinct from how words speak to us and how you can use each appropriately.
Mm-hmm. We tend to be verbally dominated. Would you agree we are a verbally dominated society as opposed to image-driven?
I would say very much so, especially in education. That's where I've seen it the most, because in public life, we are, I think, a little more balanced. We have advertising, which is very visual. We have signage, which is visual. But somehow in our formal business, work, and school life, we seem to revert to the word.
Part of this exhibit features a collaboration between you and the late Daniel Del Solar, a well-known Bay Area artist and photographer, where you explored this idea of visual communication with your photographs from Spain. Tell us more about that project.
Well, we both we went together to Spain on a two-week adventure and came back with probably 2,000 photographs each of these of these 2 weeks. And then as artists self-imposed upon us a little exercise, which was to whittle those down to about 88 images, each of us contributing our best, and then without using any words in our internet email communications, to edit them into a publication that we would then publish as Latinize.
And had you been to Spain before?
Yeah, I had studied in Spain back in the 70s.
Okay. So did you have images that you anticipated capturing before the visit?
No, and the project just emerged after the visit. It was sort of, here we are with 2,000 images.
Okay.
Why don't we do X?
Yeah. And how did you come to agreements on pairings? Were there visual arguments, so to speak, that you two had during the process?
Yeah, there were times when one image would be taken out or paired with another, and then it would come back to me, and it would be back where it had been before, and so it was a matter of almost stubbornness. And after a while, when you're dealing with 88 images contributed by two different people, you sort of lose track of whose images are whose, then they become a sort of collective images, which was sort of an interesting byproduct of the process, was sort of the stripping away of ego. Something that I think we look for when we're looking for collaboration is less of the I and more of the we. And it happened more easily, I think, with images than it would have with words.
What do you hope people will take away from this exhibit? Do you think they'll be able to detect the kind of dynamic that you just described?
I think we as viewers bring a great deal of our own history to the images, but I think some of the pairings are obvious, their contrasts, or their almost a joke on each other. Others will be more dealing with composition. But what I hope they come away with is the fact that we have more tools available to us for communicating than just the word. We have music, dance, theater, visual arts, media. And to become really full-fledged communicators, the more access we have to those tools, the better. So let's not always rely and defer to the word, because there are some things that images can tell us much more effectively.
We're talking to photographer and artist Ana Luisa Cardona. You've been a strong advocate for arts education. As we mentioned, you're a consultant with the Michigan Arts Education Instruction and Assessment. And while with the Department of Education, you worked on the Michigan Arts Education K-12 standards. What are the basic standards school districts should adopt? Can you talk to us about that?
Basically, they mimic the creative process. So the standards are organized around create, perform, and respond. So the act of creating from something from nothing, the act of performing, using the tools and skills of that specific art form in order to express yourself, and then responding, which is the reflection, thinking about. And it's an iterative process, and it's something that you can start very young and continue to, as I do today, to continue to reflect upon my work. And so those are the basic standards.
Create, reform, respond.
Create, perform.
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 Okay. Create, perform, respond.
Respond. Right.
The Lansing School District recently, in a cost-cutting move, cut more than 80 teachers certified to teach art, music, and phys ed last spring. In your view, does it matter if the teacher is certified to teach art?
What the research tells us is that it does matter, because a certified teacher has preparation in the knowledge of that content area and how to teach that content area to students, as well as how to connect it to other subject matters. And so someone who does not have that preparation will not have those skills in order to develop their own skill as an artist, so that you're giving students the best there is in terms of modeling resources. And then you also have to know how to present it to students, a variety of students across grade levels. And so what the research tells us, and the research is what we present in the Michigan Arts Education Instruction and Assessment Program, which we refer to as MIA, is that it does in fact matter that the teacher that is teaching the art form is certified, which means it's a guarantee that you know that person has preparation. Until 2006, there were no arts education requirements in K-12 Michigan education. So there's no guarantee that a teacher who has a general education certification may have had any arts education in their entire preparation.
Talk to us more about the resources that arts teachers need, though.
Well, they range from everything from professional development in their own field and the professional development of their colleagues in arts education so that there's a common understanding of what students are doing when they're creating, performing, and responding. It may involve facilities. If you're teaching dance, then you want to make sure that you are able to move chairs in your classroom, that you have, when you get into the more advanced levels, that you have a floor that is not going, students won't injure themselves on. It involves time with students. So the amount of time that students have to dedicate to each of the four art forms is critical in terms of how deeply they're going to learn that art form and how college-bound and career-ready they're going to be when they graduate from the schools.
To people who choose the well-trod route of balancing limited school budgets by cutting the arts and music first, how do you respond?
What we've seen and what the research across the country tells us that it's not necessarily a matter of budget. It tends to be leadership. And so taking the same resources and deciding to reallocate them deliberately is the first step that needs to happen. So we know that we're a long way to go, but unless we have a shared vision of what we want for students and that it includes creativity and preparation creativity, then what we offer are some tools so that schools can plan their path to that vision that they have for students.
You have a meet and greet plan that's associated with your exhibit. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this afternoon, 3:30 to 5:30 at the Nisbet Building in Suite 301. I'll be there, and also shared with the photography is stage sets and costumes from the MSU of production of Cyrano, which is a wonderful add-on. So the photographs are hanging along with part of the stage from Cyrano, and the costumes are standing right by it. So I'm eager to meet the students who were working on that production and also to greet anyone who wishes to stop by.
Ana Luisa Cardona is a Michigan-based artist and arts education advocate. You can check out her exhibit, Visual Dialogues, at MSU Global, which is, as you just heard, in the Nisbet Building here on the campus. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll learn about international food fraud. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment will feature the Refugee Development Center. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR.